difference isn't between pastors that have mixed motivations and those who have pure motivations. It's more like those that are aware of their mixed motivations and actively holding them up to the light before God and other people and even their own church, and those that are either in denial or worse, hiding their mixed motivations.
Well, hey, friends, it's Jason here. Thanks for joining us for another episode of the Canadian Church Leaders Podcast. Today, our guest is John Mark Comer. He was in Vancouver recently as part of the launch of his most recent book, and he very kindly sat down with us in person for the conversation. Many of you know John Mark. He's the founding pastor of Bridgetown Church in Portland, Oregon. He's the author of many best-selling books like The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry or his most recent book, Practicing the Way. John Mark's work has deep resonance across many generations in the church today. He has stirred a conversation about what it means to be a disciple of Jesus, to be with Jesus, to become like him and do what he did in the midst of our modern world. Today, he works with Practicing the Way, an organization that's building high-quality resources for free for the local church that enables pastors to introduce their congregation to practices like fasting, prayer, scripture, and other spiritual disciplines. In our conversation, we covered a lot of ground. One of the themes that most had an effect on me personally was about practices that pastors can integrate into their lives for longevity and health in ministry. Things like Sabbath, rest, knowing your own wiring, and the importance of long-term and brutally honest friendships. We hope you find our conversation helpful today, and if you want to watch it, you can see the whole thing on our YouTube channel. Practicing the Way is launching a brand new resource, an 8-week course designed for local churches to run with their congregations. It's an on-ramp to spiritual formation, exploring what it means to follow Jesus and laying the foundation for a life of apprenticeship to him. It includes beautiful films, a companion guide, discussion questions, and weekly practices. As a church at The Way, we're rolling this out this fall in all of our small groups. The course is available now for free, and you can find out more at practicingtheway.org. Before we jump into our conversation with John Mark, here's a quick word from our friends at the Canadian Bible Society.
Now, before we jump in, I want to thank our friends at the Canadian Bible Society who make this episode possible. We want to highlight a resource they developed called the Bible Course, a course that was created to help the average person engage with God's Word in a deeper way. The Bible Course includes 8 weeks of video teaching that are all designed to connect the events, books, and characters of Scripture together into one big story. This course can easily be run in small groups, and even is a great follow-up to something like Alpha, if you're running that. To check out the first video for free and to learn more about the course, just head to BibleSociety.ca/thebiblecourse, and you'll find all you need. That's BibleSociety.ca/thebiblecourse.
Well, John Mark, good to have you.
It's great to be here.
I'm so glad you included Canada on your book tour.
Oh, I love Canada. We took the train up this morning, my son and I, from Seattle, and I have just, you know, been coming up here a lot the last 2 years. I have fallen in love with British Columbia.
You're on a book tour right now, and you've had different stops along the way. How's it been? What are you experiencing? What are you seeing and hearing? And I'd just love to hear a bit about it.
You know, the one thing I'm really loving is, I've been in this kind of lane of working out spiritual formation in kind of post-Christian culture in a city like, you know, I was in Portland for 20 years, now I'm in L.A., similar to Vancouver in a lot of ways. And, you know, it's always felt like you're kind of the loner out there.
Yeah.
You know, most of the people in the formation movement are all 20, 30 years older than me, coming out of conservative Christian culture. Very few working in, you know, kind of more post-Christian, secular, progressive kind of spaces. And it's always felt a little bit more bespoke. Mm. You know, the kind of pastoral theology that works and plays well in urban progressive centers is different in my country, but probably very different than in Canada. And, you know, in America, the dominant kind of pastoral imagination still comes out of the South and out of kind of Southern megachurches, and very different culture. I mean, radically different than the one I've spent my whole life in. And not better or worse, just very different. All that to say, I am loving, there is like a, hunger is an overused word by Christians, but there is a palpable desire, openness, interest, thirst, whatever, from a broad range of different types of Christians in different cultural contexts for, let's just put it under the rubric of formation, for a different set of metrics for success that I'm hearing from pastors. The kind of, you know, questions that I'm hearing pastors asking are very different than the ones that I'm used to from the last 20 years of my life. They're just about different metrics. And that I'm just loving. I mean, we did a night, each, you know, there's a host church everywhere I go. And so we were with Matt Chandler and the Southern Baptists one night. I couldn't believe I got invited, you know, and it was lovely. And then we were with Anglicans the next night, and then Presbyterians, and then I was with Jay Pathick and the Vineyard in Denver, and then in Silicon Valley with non-denominational people. And it was just like, I cannot believe the diversity here of ecclesiology, and yet the common denominator is a real interest in all things formation, and at a pastoral level, the integration of formation into the church. And that's just new. I'm used to hearing resistance from pastors, not interest.
What do you think is maybe driving some of that?
I think the job got a lot harder, you know, after COVID, and in America before that with the election of President Trump. The rules all started to change. You know, there's that in work, like experts on burnout talk about three kind of levers, if you imagine that you have to balance to kind of maintain emotional health in your job and maintain energy for your work. And one is like responsibility. So too much responsibility and you're stressed, and that's taxing on your nervous system, and the end result is burnout. Too little responsibility and you're bored, and that isn't taxing on your nervous system, but it will actually like breed in like a fugue or a lethargy or a sloth, right? Sometimes the solution to burnout is not rest, it's like more work.
Meaningful work.
Yeah, and that's meaningful, that's interesting, that's on the growth edge for you. Then the other kind of lever would be freedom. And, or really, control is a better word, meaning how much of a direct link do you see between the work you do and the outcomes? Is it like, I work harder, I work smarter, I bring more gifting, and I have better outcomes, or not? So like Marx, you know, in this political world, Marx built a whole political philosophy out of what he called the alienation of the worker in response to industrialism, which is like the pinnacle of no control, where the worker is like a cog on an assembly line. There's no link between. You're just the same thing over and over. It's not like old school world where, you know, you were a woodworker and you would cut down a tree and hone it. You'd meet the person.
Give it to somebody that you know is going to have that.
And they would say thank you a year later. We're eating dinner at the table you made us, you know. So a direct kind of sense of, oh, wow, link and control. And then the third lever is reward, like how rewarding is the work. And that could be financial. It could be I make a lot of money. It could be flexibility. I work remote and I only, you know, I work whatever hours I want. It could be meaning, like I have a really meaningful job. Social work is really hard. It's really demanding, but I know I'm saving people's lives or whatever. And so pastoral work has always been high responsibility. Like it's really hard to do it and have that lever be in a healthy spot. It's always like the black hole of need. It's always been low control. Because people are not widgets, and people have an extraordinary amount of agency. So even in a hypothetical universe where you pastor perfectly, and you do all the right things and you make no mistakes, very hypothetical universe, still your people could do all sorts of wonky things.
Yeah.
And so, you know, sometimes our churches really don't do well because we mucked it up. Sometimes we did everything right and they still don't do really well.
As a side note, sometimes I think we're too hard on ourselves as pastors, and it's always, I'm realizing this as a pastor now, how in the past, I'm sure I'm the only one that was critical of other pastors and other churches, especially when I was young.
In your youth,
yeah. And like, and I'd be like, man, like I'd be in a staff position at church being like, our church doesn't pray enough, or it doesn't have a culture of dependency enough. And now I'm leading a church and it doesn't pray as much as I wish it did. It doesn't have a culture of, you know, whatever, enough hospitality. And I'm like, I don't even know how to do it. And I'm doing my best out here. Like,
nobody has more quote power than I do. And I can't move
I can't
the
make
needle.
It happen.
I can't make it happen. 100%. But then pastoring has always been high reward. So the refrain, at least prior to maybe 5 or 6 years ago in the U.S., was, you know I can make a lot more money for a lot less effort doing something else, but this is really meaningful, and I really feel like I'm helping and I'm serving. But I think what's happened, at least since COVID in America, before that, with the real wedge of political polarization, is those levers have all changed, and now it's even more responsibility, even less control, but then the major difference is the reward has gone way down. And I don't mean reward like in the New Testament sense of the reward of Jesus. That
like
is
the
coming.
Ultimate reward.
Yes, no, if anything, more. That's more true than ever before, you know? But the sense of emotional kickback for the job is less and less appealing. And that's changed the game. And the older models that worked for a while are just increasingly less and less effective. And so a lot of pastors, I think, have this feeling of like, it's more work than it's ever been, but it's like the diminishing law of returns. It's like, I keep putting more effort in and it just keeps going, just inching down or whatever. Not all pastors feel that way, but a lot that I interact with do. And that's sad, and there's lots there to we could unwind. But the beauty of that is I think it opens people to change, to new pastoral imagination, to new models of church, to new metrics for success, to new rhythms of life and pace of church life. And I think all of that was long overdue. And so, you know, I don't want to downplay the hardship right now. Pastoring is, I think, especially hard right now. But I do celebrate the fact that I think there's a new opening from people to new models of church, new ways of being. And some of that is just the hard stuff. Some of it's just we're still wrestling with the fallout of the digital age. And I don't think we really want to honestly talk about the impact it's had on local churches.
And our spirituality.
The impact it's had on preaching is really profound. And so I think, you know, we are late adopters, in a sense, to some of the changes that will probably become inevitable in the years to come.
A couple of parts that I want to lean into. One is, you know, we have brothers and sisters around the world who experience persecution. And it's just still in North America, that's not the even close to a normative experience. There could be some isolated pockets, but generally, you know, we're safe. We're not experiencing. But it is very disorienting, the falling out of favor. And I was just reflecting, I was speaking to a bunch of leaders from Young Life. And my dad was a Young Life worker back in the day. And I remember 25 years ago, if he was at my soccer game or something, and he told somebody he met, another dad, oh, what do you do? He, you know, I work for Young Life. What's Young Life? It's like, oh, we do work, Christian organization working with teenagers. Even in Canada, it was kind of like, oh, good for you. Like, not very interested, but it was still this, the tone was kind of good for you. And that, for a lot of us growing up around ministry, tasted a little bit of that, at least socially. Not a lot of interest, not a high reward, but it really was like, yeah, good for you, man. You're a pastor. And that's changed very fast, where it's like, what do you do? I do Christian youth work.
I work for a nonprofit.
I do Christian youth work. And it's like, you know, it's like skeptical.
Absolutely.
That seems threatening. And as much as it seems almost embarrassing for me to compare my experience to our brothers and sisters, which I never would, like, we're actually experiencing persecution, we just don't have a theology or a practice, I should say, for ministry where we are out of favor. And I think that that's really disorienting. And it's like, I'd love to be the kind of person that's unaffected by how I'm perceived by my peers, but I am. And I'm trying to discover, I think what I love about it, though, is it's forcing us to all swim for deeper waters where our reward is in the Lord.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, I wonder how have you experienced that, or how does that map over what you're seeing?
I mean, 100%, and I'm of an age where I experienced a rapid decline in that. You know, younger pastors coming up, that will be all they ever know. And, you know, and again, it's good and it's bad. I mean, historically, I agree. I don't think persecution is the right word for what we're facing. I think a, like, cultural hostility and shame is the right word. There's like an emotional shaming component to it that is palpable, you know? And we have a deep bodily need to be loved and feel safe. And that's less and less true in a city like Vancouver or, you know, LA. And historically, you know, corruption in the church, I've been thinking so much about just the litany of pastoral scandals over the last 10 years in particular, and it is just—
Is there any data yet of whether it's increased or just our access to the stories increased? Because I've been wondering, like, has this always been the case? Like, if I'm sure it's tough to research that, but do you know if there's any sort of, like—
I've been asking the question, and I can't get a good, reliable answer.
Hmm.
So if somebody's listening and you work in reliable data—
Yeah, it's just interesting because, like, I think part of it is we have so much access to these stories in real time.
Yes.
Through blogs, through—
I'm
Twitter.
Sure that's some of it. This is a sidebar conversation. I think fame is a giant part of it, and fame is new. I mean, there's always been a C.H. Spurgeon or a John Wesley, but the proliferation of well-known pastors in large churches is historically has pretty much no parallel.
Wow. Yeah.
And then literally mediated through the internet. That's a new phenomenon, and I think it plays a gigantic role. So I know there are pastors that are not famous that have blown their lives up and caused all sorts of damage. But so that doesn't answer all of it. But I know that's the perfect storm of fame does something to deform the soul, and very few people, I think, have the capacity of character to steward fame, which is a form of power, to steward it without it, you know, corrupting them.
Mm.
And then when that's combined with a journalistic power analysis, everybody has access kind of culture, you just can't hide it. You know, I think it was a lot easier to hide kind of some of the stuff that right now people get outed for. I think it was easier to hide in previous eras. So I think it's probably both. I don't know the answer to that question. But I know this, that corruption in church leadership is not a new problem. It goes back to the 4th century. Mm. Basically started with Christendom and has never left us. And, you know, you have extraordinary low amounts of corruption in the moments when the church is under persecution. First 3 centuries, it's almost non-existent. And that's because, you know, we hear about early church persecution, but rarely was it like indiscriminate, the Roman legions coming in and just killing women and children. That did happen, but very rarely. Mostly it was targeted persecution, where the Roman officials would come in and they would arrest the bishop, key pastors, and wealthy people of influence, kind of people of privilege that were a member of the church, like Perpetua and Felicity, if you're familiar with that story. And they would imprison them, and they would demand they recant their faith, or they would torture and kill them. And you can imagine how, if you're thinking about, you're praying about becoming a pastor, and you know that there's a high likelihood that if you are successful as a pastor, you will be imprisoned, stripped of all your possessions, and possibly brutally and painfully murdered. You can imagine that would have a purifying effect on your motivational structure.
Yeah.
As opposed to now, where people are thinking, man, if I do this right, if I'm successful, I could get a following, I could get a book deal, I can maybe get a good salary out of this, I could get people that like me and follow me and accolades for me. That's just you have this whole gravitational pull to all the wrong motivational structures. And that's nothing new. Paul is writing about it in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, where he's, you know, talking about church leaders. We apply that wood, hay, stubble thing to everyone, but that's about church leaders and about what foundation are you building your community upon. And, you know, there's that line about how Jesus will judge the thoughts and intents of the heart. And that is, like, so sobering for me, just because I'm very aware that there are thoughts and intentions in my heart that have nothing to do with loving God and loving my neighbor as myself, but that are, you know, rooted in other broken, egotistical, self-preserving aspects of myself. And I'm aware of that, and I think that's in all of us, and I think the difference isn't between pastors that have mixed motivations and those who have pure motivations. It's more like those that are aware of their mixed motivations and actively holding them up to the light before God and other people and even their own church, and those that are either in denial or worse, hiding their mixed motivations. I do think we're in a moment where the cultural shame is strong enough that it has the potential to really purify our motivational structure and to let us be in this a little bit more for the right reasons.
One of the things I'm observing, we were just
away, like just straight before this, with CC Line on a little pastor's retreat, and you joked about the word hunger being an overused Christian word. But man, the hunger in the room, like when we're singing together, like when Mark Buchanan was speaking, and he said,
love his work.
He was just, he's so wonderful. And he said, I wish your churches could hear you sing. Mm. And it really was stunning. Like there was moments where I just stopped singing because I had just, because I was involved with it, it was towards the front, but I could hear the choir of pastors singing behind. It was just Jer on a guitar leading. And there was like a quality in the room that I haven't experienced with just 50 pastors spending time and then going singing hymns, singing, and some stillness that you could feel the hunger in the room. And I feel like both, I think it's like people are swimming for deeper waters.
Yeah. I did notice that too. We've done a pastor's conference the last couple of years with Practicing the Way. And you know, normally pastor's conferences are the worst. It's like this weird like return to high school alpha dynamics.
Yeah.
And it's like during the singing, people are like, you know, arms crossed. You could just read the cynicism on people's face, the critical spirit. And all the like more successful pastors aren't even in the room. They're like hanging out, drinking coffee backstage somewhere or out in the hallways, just chatting through the whole thing. And yeah, the first year we did this and I was just shocked. I remember I was sitting next to John Ortberg, who was our speaker that night. And he leaned over. Now, granted, he's a Presbyterian, but he's not actually a Presbyterian, but he was in a Presbyterian church for a long time. He leaned over and he said, man, these pastors sing.
Yeah.
Because they were just like belting it out and like everybody was there present. And I thought, man, I've been at this for a while. I have never seen this before.
Mm.
So yeah, same, sounds like a very similar experience.
It really encourages my heart. I think it's, I haven't worked out, I'm sure there's tons of, it's a work of the Spirit. The Lord's doing something in our time. But I think it's, hey, we're not as confident in our models anymore. Mm-hmm. So we need the Spirit. I need a touch from God. I need His love. I need His comfort and strength because I'm not comforted in my work. And then I think it's this longing for, I think there's this real faith that, this sounds so basic, that it's like, I think the gospel's true. That Jesus does actually have good news for us and a desire to go after the real thing as like the sort of shadow of the real thing, the Christendom piece is sort of disappearing, but also like the secular promise is also evidently failing in front of us.
Nobody is saying enough about the secularism is crumbling before our eyes.
Yes.
America is crumbling before our eyes. Thank God you all live in Canada. You know, I mean, yes, the church is not doing well, but the country is doing 1,000 times worse, you know?
Yeah.
So, yes.
Yeah, I'm encouraged. And I think when I was reflecting on your book, Practicing the Way, and I was curious, and you might not like this question because it's kind of one of those ones, like, at least a Canadian wouldn't like this question, but I'm going to ask it anyways. I'm struck by the resonance it's having across generations. So Gen Z's reading it, and it feels like it's speaking their language. And then I'm across the table from a couple, I think in their 70s, and they're reading it, and it's resonating deeply. Like, and that's really unique, you know? It's like, I think we'd all be thrilled to know that anything that we write or create resonates with a generation, let alone across. I'm curious what you think it is that is resonating across even generational lines.
You know, I think whenever you begin to name something that should be normal but isn't, very little is said about, I think there's some lightning rod moment that happens. So, you know, yes, this book, I've been, in a sense, people ask me, you know, how long did you spend writing the book? I never know how to answer that question. You know, most of writing is not writing. It's learning and living and failing and succeeding a little bit and rewriting and editing and getting criticism and thinking about the criticism. You know, there is a little short window in the middle where you sit down in front of a computer and you spend, you know, a number of weeks writing out a rough draft. But my first research file for this book was in 2010.
Wow.
Just because I've known for most of my ministry, I wanted to write a book about apprenticeship to Jesus. Mm. And so I've been teaching on apprenticeship, formation, the inner life for quite a while now. And some of it's very basic. I mean, hopefully I'm doing some stuff in the book that is interesting for somebody But a lot of it's just like very basic. This is what it means to be an apprentice of Jesus. These are the three goals of an apprentice, how you follow Jesus. And there's this kind of refrain. Like, I always pay a lot of attention to common criticisms and common compliments that I get, because I think probably if you hear things repeated like that, there's a good amount of truth in them. And I want to both get better at the good and better at the bad too, you know, that, and lower the lower the level on the stuff that I'm missing. And one common refrain that I would hear every time I would go out and speak, I would hear it at our church in Portland from older people, is, I've been a Christian 20 years. I've been a Christian 35 years. I've been a Christian, whatever, for a long time. How is it I have never heard anybody talk about this? Whether it's just the nature of the gospel as, you know, the good news about the kingdom of God, or the call to apprenticeship to Jesus, or how we are actually formed, or the role of practice, or the crucial role of community, not as defined as hundreds of people around a stage, but people doing life together and knowing and being known. Just basic. This is basic stuff. But there is, for some, there's just a couple, I think, glaring holes in at least evangelical theology. And I think every generation has to do that work of kind of recapturing what we've missed, you know? And evangelicalism was doing that early on. Protestantism was doing that early on. We've missed the Bible. Hey, we've missed witness to others. Hey, we've missed, you know, the role that in Christendom, you need to have a moment with God, you personally. Yes. Like, they're recapturing things. And of course, you know, evangelicalism, for all sorts of reasons, did not work very hard to have a holistic model, at least in America. In England, it did, which is why evangelicalism was so different in the UK than in the US. And I think has a much stronger legacy than it does here. But I think people want to follow Jesus, and here, to shoot very straight, I think the evangelical, I'll use that in the broadest kind of Protestant stream, has had a very low success rate at producing high levels of transformation and healing in a large number of people. I think it has been very strong on evangelism, people coming to faith, and the early stages in the spiritual journey. And it has really struggled to go beyond kind of the midpoint of the spiritual journey and lead people into deeper healing and change. And so whenever you begin to attempt to articulate what life is like on the second half of the spiritual journey, and what a possible pathway into that second half and into the, you know, kind of higher levels, deeper levels, whatever you, however you want to frame it, of change, healing, formation, growth, I think people begin to just leap forward, because most talk in Christian culture is still on the conversion end and on the early stages in the spiritual journey, which is not bad at all. Again, it's just, I think there's something missing there. So maybe that's it, Jay. I don't know. I would love to hear your theories. I never thought about that, honestly.
I mean, I think it was Willard, maybe it was Willard, that just talked about his, like, disdain for vagueness. You ever hear, like just didn't like words that were, like, broad and undefined. But you hear, you see in his writings, always trying to, like, define things.
Well, yeah, no, one of the hallmarks of his mind was he had these little one-word definitions.
And we had Jeff Vanderstelt on the podcast recently, and I asked him a question. I said, why do you, because, you know, his emphasis is discipleship and really wanting to put language to it. And I said, why do you think something that's so central to Christianity, just like it's one of our main things, like we are disciples. It's like,
it is arguably the thing. It is the thing.
And one thing I appreciate about him is he's worked to bring definition to the gospel, gospel fluency. And I said, why do you think it's something so central has stayed so vague? You have conferences being like, what is discipleship? And we have conversations like, you know, we hired discipleship pastors as if it's a stream and these different things. And then his response really shocked me. He was like, he had some other thoughts, but one of his first things he said was, I think it's partly demonic that if we can keep something abstract, then you'll never be accountable for it. And he gave a bunch of other thoughts, but what I was so struck by that is,
the enemy is a master of confusion.
If we keep it vague and I think part of what's refreshing about, I think this conversation around spiritual formation is, I think people are after, like, they want to go to deeper waters, like we talked about, but also, like, I want to integrate my faith into my day-to-day life in a way that actually is transforming and real. Like how does this actually hit the ground of day-to-day life, going to my work, going to my school, whatever it might be? And I think that part of it is articulating a vision that is, it touches the ground enough that it's not just in the realm of ideas, though our ideas are deeply important. It actually puts in the realm of practice.
Yes.
I think that's part of it.
Well, that's part of the problem with the evangelical model of change, is it was kind of information and inspiration, and then it was down to willpower. You know, so it never went beyond kind of this aspirational ideal, and now go do it. With platitudes like in the power of the Spirit and rely on God, which is theologically true, and that's good advice, but unless if that's translated into a, how do I do that? I was thinking about this morning. I had to leave. I'm traveling right now, and I hate traveling because I have a sensitive nervous system. I'm a creature of habit. I like my daily rhythms. And, you know, when you're traveling, it's just these, like, 18-hour days, and it's chaotic, and it's stressful. And I read a psalm before I, like, rushed out the door this morning in Seattle. And I was just in the back of an Uber just thinking, how am I going to practice the presence of God today?
Yeah.
I'm so tired, and I don't. You know, and so it's like, how do you it's a beautiful idea. Like, I want to spend this day with Jesus. But how do you translate that into a workable way of life?
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, I think a lot about that.
I want to pivot a little bit. But I'm curious about, you know, because a lot of the work you're articulating right now is like practices for the digital age, practices for our life today. And they're not necessarily new practices, they're ancient practices being articulated for our contemporary moment. I'm just curious, as you think about your life as a pastor, what kind of practices, maybe they're not just unique to pastoring, but like, what are some of the essential formative practices that pastors must go after?
Yeah, I think, first off, I think it's a great question. I think there are other ways to frame it, but one way to frame how you think about your own discipleship is through the lens of like, what are the problems we're solving for? So like historically, every rule of life that's ever been written down through the annals of church history was always written to combat unique problems of that day and era, or unique problems of that role. So for example, when the mendicant orders come about in the 12th century, the Franciscans, the Dominicans, this is a new moment. It's the first time you have church, you have religious orders that aren't going to build monasteries and like the Benedictines take a vow of stability and stay in one place. They're going to take a vow to go. And they were originally preaching orders, like the Franciscans and the Dominicans. They would go. The Dominicans were sent out to combat heresy and to preach, and the Franciscans to renew corruption in the clergy, right? So there are these going to be these traveling, preaching, kind of roving bands of like kind of modern day apostolic, you know, at the time, preachers. And so they take a different set of vows than, say, Benedictines or more traditional orders, one of which is the vow of poverty. And I always read that and thought, man, this feels like such an extreme, you know, hyper-literal overreading of Jesus' teachings on money. Jesus' teachings on money are very intense.
Yeah.
But to go to, like, full non-possession feels like, am I missing something? But then you realize that this is at the height of like the corrupt clergy, where you know, this is at the full height of Christendom, the melding of, you know, economic, political, and religious power, and local like pastorates and bishoprics were bought and sold like real estate, like commodities. So if you're a wealthy patriarch, you would buy, you know, the lead pastor role for the Way of Vancouver, and you'd give it to your son, who might be a womanizing idiot who doesn't even believe in God, but you'd put him in there because it comes with land and holdings and tax. I mean, the level of corruption is extreme. Makes today, makes the church today look bright and shiny, you know. So here come these like young pastors, these young leaders that realize we have to resist this. So they took a vow of poverty.
Wow.
It's really hard to get sucked into the corruption of money when you vow non-possession. So that's just one extreme
example. That's such a helpful framework, because I think that's probably part of, like, as we pastor our congregations, like, everyone has to build a rule of life or a pattern that allows them to grow in Jesus in their unique context. It's so unique. And I guess... I think the reframe helps, because asking the question, like, what are the practices for pastors in our time in North America?
So, okay, so there's three, there's longer lists than this, but, you know, a good like reflection exercise that you could do alone if you're listening or with a few friends is just to attempt to name like, hey, what are the unique dangers, temptations, pitfalls, deformative, you know, aspects of pastoring today in your context, in your church? So it seems to me there's at least a couple: exhaustion, isolation, and the shadow. And you could name others, pride, several others you could name. So, but you know, and the use of power. So for exhaustion, I think that, you know, a high intentional, disciplined, sustained effort toward rest is extraordinarily important. So I would like to borrow the concept of load management from the world of sports. I'm not an athlete. I know barely anything about sports, but I find sports psychology fascinating. And apparently, this is my understanding, that load management started in baseball, where, and I had to learn about this, where apparently, you know, a pitcher was often the one that will carry a team to victory. But when they get into the, what's the World Series, right? So then they have all these games back to back, but you can't pitch games back to back. And so then the kind of key star player that got them to where they are has to be really careful, because they can throw out their arm and be out of the game permanently or lose the series. So they developed this concept of load management. How much can you pitch? How many minutes? And where do you spend those minutes? Because everybody would love to have the best pitcher pitching the whole time, but you can't. They will throw out their arm, the whole team will lose. So you have to be really careful in calculating that. Now it's translated over to basketball. And, you know, it's controversial, because nobody wants to pay whatever it costs to, you know, go to a basketball game and see, you know, LeBron James just like
not playing,
caring for his soul, and just like sitting there in sweatpants, just, you know, loving on his teammates and just drinking some herbal tea. Nobody wants to see that. But yet that's what he needs, you know. So I think applied to pastoring, the leadership principle there would be, the more essential your role is to your organization or your community, and the more stress, pressure, responsibility, the more is riding on you and your work and your kind of outcomes, the more important rest becomes for you, which is very counterintuitive, because we often think, I have more responsibility now, which translates to less rest. And I've, you know, I don't know a lot of the like mega famous pastors, but I've met a couple of them, and I've been struck by how profoundly calm and unhurried their lives are. And they're not, you would think they're all working 100 hours a week like a partner in a law firm, and they're not. I remember Andy Stanley, totally different stream of the church, totally different, you know, kind of charism than what I'm about. But I remember when I was a young pastor hearing him give this lecture once, and he said, if you can't do your job in 40 hours, you're a bad pastor. And at the time I was church planning. I was working like 80 hours. And I was like, what do you know, man? Nobody can do their job in 40 hours. What kind of slacker works 40 hours a week? And now I really agree. If you can't do it in the allotted time, then something is not right, you know? So I think there's a wisdom there that often you will see in pastors that have gone the distance. They don't have this hurried, frenetic, which is so often driven by our ambition and our anxiety. I mean, so often what's driving that is not like a healthy sense of mission and call. It's ambition and it's anxiety. It's that deep shadow.
And people pleasing.
People pleasing. Yeah, exactly.
And people or addiction pleasing. To success or whatever, all those things.
Image management. It could be a thousand different things, but there's something under there.
You know, it hits real home for me, because I had a lot of ideals I carried into this season I'm in of lead pastoring, about good ideals. Like, I want to be with my team. I want to be on the ground doing it. I'll even first man in, last man out, all these things.
All these things, yeah.
And I think there's obviously an algorithm at play, because there's the weight of ministry. There's the season of life. Like, you know, in my 20s, I wasn't very effective, but I could put the hours in. And it was like there was a social dynamic to it. There's all these other reward mechanisms built into it. But I carried a lot of ideals, and I don't think I put too much pressure on myself, but I've just been really struck by, I can't do it. I can't keep all these ideals. And part of it is just the weightiness of leading a church. And I know when I was a youth pastor, there's real weight, like weighty stuff. But it's a different weight. And that idea of load management, it's almost like it's not like, yeah, because I remember hearing even Stanley talk about that and being like, that's silly. And I think that there's an overdo on it for sure.
Yes.
But I find myself asking the question now, like, how am I going to do this with joy
yes.
and effectiveness for the long haul?
And how are you going to do it 50 years from now or, yeah, or 10 years
from now? I could do
now.
2 more years at a crazy clip. I could pull off 2 more years, but
you
not
do,
20
anybody
more.
Can do almost anything for 2 years.
Yes, but not 20, and definitely not with joy.
Yeah, and that's my problem is, you know, I have a pretty high, this is me personally, I have a really high capacity for task, but I actually have a pretty low ceiling for my like emotional capacity to joyfully and peacefully hold stress.
Mm.
So what happens is every day I have this like kind of invisible ceiling.
Yeah.
And if I go over it, which I can go way over it and get a lot done, I just become this miserable, grouchy, impatient, nitpicky, unpleasant person to be around, namely with my family.
Yeah, and that's what we bring home.
Yeah, I can fake it a bit with our staff and, you know, unless if they're really close to me, but I can't fake it at home.
Mm-hmm.
And so every day I face the temptation. And it's funny how it gets more acute when you get older. Like there's this conspiracy where, you know, I chat with this with a dear friend of mine a lot who's in the marketplace in business, but we're the same age, and he's been very successful in his work. Where, you know, we're both like kind of at the peak of, to use secular language, our career. And it's like never before have I been able, had so much high leverage where I can like, I can narrow my work to like my gifting, and I can put hours in and almost instantaneously see something good come out of it.
Yeah.
And so never before, you know, in a sense, we're like at the height of our powers, you know, it's, I'm saying that tongue in cheek. But we have kids. And, you know, in developmental psychology, they talk about how kids' primary emotional home goes from mom to dad to mentor through three phases. Through, you know, there's not an exact age, but kind of 1 to 9, 9 to 16, and 16 up. Different for each kid. So my kids are all in that middle dad stage. Mm. And so the moral of that story is every single day I face a temptation to prioritize my work over my children. And frankly, my work is a lot more rewarding short term.
Yeah.
Because it's like I can go do the work and I can write another book. I can have this thing happen. I can start a new initiative. With kids, I might do all the work. I might like set aside the whole night and plan out this night. I'm gonna take my kids out, and they just don't want to talk to me, or they're just being a punk, or they're just like, don't open up to me, or it doesn't go well, or I get annoyed and I get angry when I'm supposed to be super dad. You know, it's like, oh, it's so frustrating. And so all of that to say, you know, I know we're veering a little off topic, but yes, I could not agree more. And I think learning to discipline and to keep our work in its proper place is, and you're right, I think there's an overcorrection in particular from some, you know, younger people. But you and I share enough of a similar personality structure where I know I can moralize everything. And so pastoring, it's hard not to moralize. Like you mentioned, you know, you just said the same thing. Like, I want to be, my rule for years was I'm the first one there, I'm the last one to go home. I will lock the church building behind me. I used to show up to do setup.
I don't
want to
ask anyone to do something I wouldn't do myself.
Exactly. I will never ask anyone in my church to do anything I'm not willing to do. And I think those are both like, that second one especially, I think is actually really important.
Yes.
But that first one is more of like an aspirational idea that then I moralize.
Yeah.
But what happens when you're trying to preach three services a Sunday, or four, or in my case at the time, 6 services a Sunday, and you're trying to do that 35 Sundays a year. I mean, like, the math doesn't work. So it's a long way of saying Sabbath is beyond crucial. Retreat. Sabbath is not enough. That weekly Sabbath, the daily rest, sleep, time for your nervous system to calm, is crucial. You know, it's whole Andy Crouch's whole thing. He's like, Sabbath is not for rest. That's his whole perspective. He's like, your evening sleep and like daily routine is for rest. Like what happens after work and before work, and those kind of bookends before and after sleep and good sleep, that's when you rest. Sabbath is for delight. And if you don't rest during the week, by the time you get to Sabbath, you're just in recovery mode. You're just like in a, almost like in a, your nervous system is like in a hangover, and it's not actually a day of delight and worship. It's a day of recovery from the work. And so he's like, the nightly rest is your recovery. I don't know if I totally agree with that, but I sure love that pitch, you know. Weekly Sabbath rest, and then retreat is utterly essential. Like you, I mean, this is all over the life of Jesus. He would deeply engage and then slip back. And that's part of the load management thing. Like, I remember my, I have this brilliant therapist in his 70s who was a Quaker pastor decades ago, just full of wisdom. And he's been really helpful with me, you know, again, because I'm a workaholic at times and moralize everything. And he said, you know, don't think of your job as like a manager's schedule job. So when you're done with Sunday and you have this marathon Sunday and you preach your heart out, and even if it's not long hours, you know, preaching is just so emotionally exhausting. I've never done anything more exhausting. You know, don't think, well, the next morning the office opens at 8:30, so I need to be there at 8:30 and work a, you know, 9-hour day with a 30-minute lunch break. Or like, don't think like that. He said, think more like an athlete. And an athlete's not going for balance. They're not going for, I never want to be exhausted. Or they're going for extreme output where they leave everything on the table. Like, you have succeeded if they practically carry you off the court because you've left everything in the game. Like, they're trying to give 100%. And then extreme rest. Then you have LeBron James sleeping 12 hours a night and the personal chef and the cold plunge and like all the ultraviolet nap thing he does or whatever, like extreme load management napping. And then daily discipline where they're training almost every single day. And that's more the paradigm. Extreme output, extreme rest, daily discipline. That's more of, I think, a mental model for pastoral life rhythms than like a, I'm a project manager for Google and I work 50 hours a week from this time to this time and I have these meetings and I have this schedule or whatever. So I think rest is one of the most important practices for exhaustion, because exhaustion is the breeding ground for a lot of sin. And not even just the glamorous ones that we read about. It's the ones that cause us just to quit the race. And drop out, or not quit, but just begin to plateau. And, you know, pastoring, it's a leadership role. It's a shepherding role. So you're always kind of shepherding. You're always pushing and pulling people. And that pushing and pulling gets really tiring. It requires an emotional energy to do. And that requires rest.
I think the language of recovery has been so helpful as a reframe, because what I've noticed in some of the conversations, and even really on the nose, like someone will read Ruthless Elimination of Hurry, maybe someone younger, and they'll go, if I am tired, I've done something wrong. And that's not by any means what I hear you
say. No, I'm trying to say the opposite.
Exactly.
If you're not regularly exhausted, you're probably not doing your job right.
But the question is, if you're healthy, or I think the argument is, not, it's not wrong to be tired. It's like obvious. It's like actually we should give ourselves away for people we love.
It's a
we
generative give ourselves, life. Yeah. Yes.
But then it's like recovery is the sign of health. And do you have both practices but also health so that you can recover? It doesn't take 2 weeks or you don't live in a depleted state constantly. Can you just help articulate a little bit? Because I think that's a really important contribution to the conversation. Because I've even heard it go as far as like there's these exhausted young people that they just want to Sabbath all the time. They don't want to do any work. It's like as if Sabbath is the problem there. You know what I mean? It's like that's definitely not the problem. I think it's we don't have healthy mechanisms for rest day to day because of digital addiction. But then also like we're quick to take hold of any sort of language to make it justify, you know, unhealthy patterns.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I mean, gosh, I run into that. I run into it more and more. And this is where everything is contextualized. So you must ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life, you know, what Willard said. That was said to a boomer working at Willow Creek Community Church, this like insane type A, crazy driven, mega church, you know, kind of culture churning out all this stuff. And, you know, most lead pastor types, but not all, are very type A, driven to a fault, especially of larger churches. And so the message is, you know, you need to slow down. And a lot of the people I work with are in professional kind of urban contexts, and their spiritual journey will begin with slowing, not with, you know. But there are other people that need to hear a polar opposite message of activation. You like, yeah, get off your butt and go do what God made you do.
Participate.
A lot. In fact, that's why I think a lot of I think that's some of why my work seems to be resonating, because a lot of evangelical preaching has all been preaching to nominal apathetic Christians, trying to wake them up. There's such a revivalist spirit, at least in America. But I think most of, you know, North America, there's a revivalist spirit that is baked into evangelicalism that is constantly trying to keep the energy up. And in Christendom, you have all these nominal Christians that are apathetic and need to be activated out of the status quo. In post-Christendom, you have anxiety that needs to be calmed and exhaustion that needs to be attended to so that people can calmly do the work that God's called them to do. So I think some of, you know, what people are resonating with is just trying to articulate, you know, the call for an era. But you're right. We're reaching a tipping point, I think. And I, you know, I want to be so careful here, and this will probably be unnecessarily offensive, and it is so not my heart. But I think, you know, because no person is the same as their generation.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm very different than, like, quote, millennials or whatever. But I think as a general rule, millennials and even more so Gen Z have a fairly low emotional threshold for resilience. I think that's a true criticism. Just like I think it's true to say boomers have a pretty low, like, self-awareness, you know,
barometer. Not necessarily as a generation in touch with the deeper emotions.
The deeper feelings and their shadow and their insider self and wanting to kind of go on that inner journey and not prioritize external success over internal. You know, I think that's not true of all boomers, but that is, like, I think there's some truth in that for that generation. And I think there's some truth for millennials and for Gen Z that the need is to grow a significant amount of emotional resilience. And ironically, you know, growing up in an easier kind of era, which people don't think of it that way, but I think an objective observer would say, yes, my generation has had it easier than almost any before. It actually creates people that have a low capacity for suffering and pain. So I do think, you know, the Sabbath command is interesting. I say this a lot to our staff because we have a couple of values on our staff team, and one of which is what we call Sabbath spirituality, which is just, you know, our language for, like, we want to work diligently but unhurried. We want to, you know, live in this rhythm of work that's focused and diligent, but then Sabbath. But I always have to remind them that there are two parts to the Sabbath command. The second part is, you know, but the seventh is a day to the Lord your God, you know, on it you shall do no work. The first part is, for 6 days you shall work. Not five, by the way, for 6 days you shall work. And so the Sabbath command is actually a twofold command. It's to work for 6 days and to Sabbath for one.
Yeah.
And most people that I'm used to interacting with need to hear the second part of that, Sabbath for one. But some people need to hear the first part. For 6 days you shall work. And this is essential to what it means to be human. So I think it's a both and. Different people need to hear different things. I need to hear different things at different times in my life. There are times my, you know, general problem is overwork and exhaustion and the need to slow down. But at the same time, I you know, everything in wellness capitalism would lead us to believe that if we're tired or unhappy, we're doing something wrong and our life is bad. So unhappy, tired equals bad in the moral calculus of wellness capitalism. And that is a bankrupt way to view life. Many of the things that are most meaningful and rewarding long-term are exhausting and bring great pain into your heart. Parenting. Nothing's more exhausting than parenting, and nothing will wound and break your heart and rack you with anxiety like raising children. And yet there are few things that when we're 90 years old, we will think are more important.
And surely we'll say that was the most important thing. And we'd probably say, man, I should have potentially even poured out more of myself for it.
Oh, I can tell you that right now. In fact, I shouldn't say this, but I was listening to, this was years ago, I was listening to, I'll try to keep this really vague. There was this panel of a number of celebrity pastors who were older, who were kind of in this, like, pastoral conversation about ministry. And at one point, this very well-known pastor was asked the question, what are your regrets? And he thought for a quick second. He said, I have no regrets. And I thought, I will never listen to anything you have to say again. I mean, in all seriously, he lost all credibility in my mind. I probably wrote him off too quick, but I was like, the nerve.
Yeah.
I'm 43 and I could make you pages of regrets right now. And I can already, I mean, you know, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, the whole, the regrets of the dying, the number one regret of dying people in hospice is, I wish I had worked less hours. It's the number one regret of dying people. And so, yes, I always already very much regret the many times, the thousands of hours that I've worked when I should have been home with my kids, or giving emotional energy to my wife, or, you know.
I've taken us down a long rabbit hole.
Yeah, we've only gotten through one.
On the first. and that's a symptom of how my mind works. And I appreciate you going on that ride. But we didn't forget. What were the other two?
I don't know how much time we have. I think the practice of friendship, which you mentioned something about.
And that's a response to isolation.
To isolation.
The inherent, inherent nature of our roles as pastor is isolating. Not the only career like that. I'm sure politicians and others. But we're on a pastor's podcast here. It's like there's something very isolating about our work.
Yeah, you know, I mean, again, right now I'm working with so many pastors and getting the chance to interact with more and more. And the phenomenon of the lonely pastor is just really interesting to me.
Do you remember, by the way, one of the first times I met you, we were in a room and you shut up your hand and asked a question of Pete Cicero. Essentially, like, is it true? I don't get the words correct, wrong, but I just remember the question you asked was like, is the sentence that we're going to be lonely as pastors true? Like, is there any way around
it? Yeah, leadership is lonely. Yeah. Remember, that was the phrase. I think it originally came from Bill Hybels, and then Mark Driscoll popularized it.
Yeah.
And so I was raising the question, is leadership lonely, or is actually the way those two men led lonely? That was, I think that was my, what did he say?
No. But I did remember thinking to myself, I think where the conversation went is it's both true. There's something inherently lonely about it. However, there are practices and a pathway that doesn't have to be lonely in that full sense.
It does not have to be in that same way. Yeah, there's an existential loneliness to it that I think is just we carry. Yeah, I mean, it's bizarre, right? Because most pastors are extroverts. Not all, I'm not, but most are. And most pastors spend most of their day with people. And yet most pastors are lonely. And I think a lot of it is because we are constantly in dual relationships. So we have these genuine friendships. We like this person and we enjoy being with this person, but we're also their pastor or we're their boss or we're their co-elder or we're their employee or we're under their board's authority or they, you know, and so we're in all of these dual relationships. And, you know, for example, I loved the team that I worked with at Bridgetown. I mean, to this day, they will go to my grave with deep affinity for a couple of my main coworkers there. But at the end of the day, when I could fire them, I mean, not me, we weren't set up to where I could just have a bad day and fire them. But, you know, where I would be the one that if something were to happen, I would be the one vested in the authority from a board who would sit down and let them go. That changes a relationship. That dynamic never goes, even with mature people, even with godly people who love each other genuinely, there's a dynamic there.
Yeah.
And if it's not openly acknowledged, it can be really unhealthy, you know? And then even the really extroverted pastors, you're in these dual relationships all day, and a lot of them are relationships of obligation, you know? And that can sound really condescending, and hopefully only pastors are listening to this. But there's a lot of people that have a moralized relational expectation upon your time, that you have a vocational responsibility to meet at some level. We all do too much of it through people pleasing and such. And that can cause you to relationally max out and just be exhausted. Even because everybody has a limit to their extroversion. Yeah. Even the most extroverted people I know tap out. And then what happens is often these extroverted pastors tap out by the end of the day and they don't have any more capacity. So they don't actually have time and emotional energy to invest in these really deep relationships. I know there are pastors that don't want to be known and like the power and like the dual relationship and like this perverted way that it makes them feel. And that's that's a separate thing it's tied. But then there's a lot that I just think kind of grow isolated from people and aren't in these spaces where they're not somebody's pastor and they don't have to, you know, image management every single word, and people's faith isn't riding on their honest answer to questions.
Yeah.
And where they're deeply known and loved. And I think that being in real friendships, and I mean like long-term, brutally honest, loving, you know, brother and sister friendships, where you are known and you deeply know, where you are deeply listened to and you listen. I just think it, I don't have a strong enough word in the English language to say how important it is.
What's a practice for that? Because obviously the practice is friendship, but for you, I mean, you've moved, you're at that stage of life where, you know, kids are demanding. The friendship, you aren't running into the friends. Like, it's not like high school where it's like your friend, you see them every day.
It's
like
to be highly intentional.
So what are some of the practices for you that have allowed
you mentioned one, you know, confession. So I attempt to do weekly confession, which in the busyness of life is probably like every 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah. I do it every week on the weeks I do it.
Yeah, on the weeks I do it, I do it every week, exactly. I was listening to Tish Harrison Warren. She's like, I pray every day, which means about 4 days a week.
Yeah, it takes me 3 years to do a Bible in a year.
Yes,
that's
exactly.
Real.
I love the honesty of it. So I think confession, I'm with you. I have come full circle to the conviction that Protestants don't know how to do confession, that we threw confession out with the baby out with the bathwater, and that confession is biblically to another person, and it is naming with specificity your sin, your wickedness, and your woundedness, bearing one another's burdens, living with no secrets, coming out of the shadow into the light. And I just think it's absolutely essential that there is a person or some people from whom you have no secrets, and a place where you can live with no secrets. I just think that is absolutely, utterly essential. I think retreat can be really meaningful if you can find, you know, a small group of, especially for lead pastors, because there is such a difference between the lead pastor role and other staff pastor roles in a traditional church model. And that's probably not very popular. I'm sure a lot of the people here listening are not lead pastors, and may even have issues with that model. I totally get it. But there is such a unique existential loneliness to that role. And so I think for lead pastors especially, having friendships with other lead pastors that know what that existential loneliness is like and can share it and bear it together, for me, that has, and that comes with complications, that comes with dangers, actually, of competition and you know, stuff like different, because we have different outcomes. But I think if it can be navigated with humility and godliness, I think that's really essential. And then the other would be, we just called them transference dinners. Did I ever tell you about that story about Rollheiser in 2020? Okay, so Ronald Rollheiser, you know, just spiritual hero to me. His book, Sacred Fire, all of his books I love, but I reread Sacred Fire every single summer. I probably read it 10 times. And just extraordinary spiritual mind. And so in 2020, in that 15-minute window when online pastors' conferences were a good idea, I got asked to interview him for this online pastors' conference. And I jumped at the chance. It was like, this is my chance to meet Rollheiser. Or not meet, it was over Zoom. But I was like, I'm doing it. So we're online. This was July of 2020. My city had been on fire at that point for 30 or 40 days, quite literally, with the riots over racial injustice. It was just an absolute dumpster fire. And low point of my whole ministry, hands down. That summer was the low point of my life. And so I'm on this pastor's conference. I'm supposed to like ask pastors, you know, questions for pastors. And I'm so on the edge of quitting. I don't even care. I just come with like my questions.
Yes.
And I'm like, just ignore all of the poor pastors listening. I'm like, I hope they find this helpful. I need help. And I just went straight into like, I'm having a Zoom with Father Rollheiser. I need help. And one of the questions I asked him was, I had been learning about this psychological category of transference, which was new to me at the time. The basic concept of transference, it's kind of what it sounds like, is if somebody has been wounded in their past, their body, their limbic system has this deep emotional kind of memory of this wound that it's trying to protect itself from ever experiencing again. And if you, something about you, your role, your life, we have the potential to trigger that bodily memory, irrational, memory of somebody else doing something bad to them. And then there's a transference from their body's like memory of a traumatic experience onto you, even if you have done absolutely nothing wrong. So in my case, in that season, anybody that had ever been wounded by a man, by a white person, by a pastor, or by an authority figure, I was experiencing extraordinary amounts of transference. Mm-hmm. And people get vicious when they get activated, when their trauma is activated, they go into their limbic system, and in an attempt to shield themselves from further wounding, they will often, a certain personality type will go on the attack against them, and they will bleed and read their previous experience into you and accuse you of all sorts of things that are not true. So I was just experiencing this right and left through the racial upheaval of that summer. And it was the most wounded. I was later diagnosed with PTSD by a psychiatrist. So, I mean, based on brain scans, I mean, it was deeply painful for me. And so I asked Rollheiser, I was like, are you familiar with this concept of transference? Do you know anything about it? And he lit up. And he's like a kind of elderly academic guy, right? He doesn't like get, he's not excitable. He lit up and he goes, transference. He's an academic. So I've taught in seminaries, Protestant, Catholic, all over the world. And he said, transference is the number one thing they don't teach you in seminary that they should.
Mm.
And then he said this line. He said, seminary prepares you to do the ministry, but it doesn't prepare you for what the ministry will do to you.
Wow.
And I've been thinking about that a lot. Like, seminary and Bible training prepare us for the positive side of ministry. Like, I was just with some of your students at your college or whatever. They're probably getting trained.
Well, we're
like,
trying to trick them. We're like,
you're trying to trick them.
It's, so they just get them in the game. And then once the contract's signed,
then it's done. But I mean, it prepares us to preach and teach and learn the Bible and church history. And maybe if it's a really good seminary, here's how to do some leadership stuff. But it doesn't do a good job, as a general rule, preparing us for transference, projection, how to handle criticism, burnout, exhaustion, navigating dual relationships, deep wounding, your own failure, sin, compulsion, addiction, what to do. Like, it doesn't prepare you for that.
I realize that, and this is my own issues, it's not everyone, but I felt like I constantly needed to do PR for the local church, to the point where even in close friendships, my default answer was, ministry's hard, but it's good.
Yeah, I feel that too. Because there's so much disillusionment, we need more leaders, you feel like you gotta sell it.
And there is so much rewarding that I felt like if I just say it's hard or I'm finding it hard, not that just the work hard, but I'm like, I'm actually experiencing despair or I'm hurt by my congregation or whatever it might be. That was something that I realized it, because there's always two tracks. There's the challenges and then there's the joys. But there had to be places where I could just talk to friends and say, but I'm finding it really hard. And it's when I do that, that I can actually taste more of the joy.
Yes, absolutely. But they have to be the right people.
Yes. And they're hard. I'm finding it harder and harder to find that.
Yes, they have to be really mature. Yeah, so we started every other week, we did transference dinners. I had this big back deck at my house. We had this huge fire pit we'd built, this huge gas fire pit that would get really, really warm. And even through the winter, started it at the end of the summer and kept going. And every 2 weeks, we had a bunch of us loved to cook. And so all the elder couples would come and one or two of our key single leaders. And we would sit on our back deck, everybody bring a bottle of wine, everybody bring, you know, a dish, and we'd have this extraordinary meal. We'd drink wine together. We would just, you know, who had a hard week that week, we'd just do an affirmation circle for that person. We love you. We love this about you. This is amazing. This is what's true about you. That's not true about you. And honestly, that was the most difficult and unpleasant season of ministry in my whole life. That was the best season of eldership we ever had.
Wow, interesting.
And they're still doing it. I mean, I've left now. And last time I was in Portland for a while, they said, let's do a transference dinner. And we all went over to Tyler's house and had a great meal. Oh. And so deeply meaningful. Mm. And it just brought us together and bonded our hearts together in such a beautiful way. Mm. So I think those are some concrete practices of confession, retreat, camaraderie with other like-minded people, transference dinners. The key is, you gotta have deep friendships that last a long time. Mm. And if you look at the common, I'm studying thus failure stories, because there's so many to study. You know, Bobby Clinton's work in Making of a Leader, he argues, based on a data set of 3,000 Christian leaders in scripture, church history, and the contemporary church, that only 30% of Christian leaders end well. Mm. And that is not a good number. So, I mean, can you imagine if you're in a room with 100 pastors, 70 of them statistically will not end well. Mm. 30 will make it to the end. And I sure hope that's not true of the rooms I'm in, but man, that's the statistic. So I just been searching for common denominators too. And not, that doesn't mean that everybody will blow their life up in some spectacular fashion, you know. But for sure, one common denominator in every single story I know is isolation. Mm. And, you know, that's not just solved by having a weekly touch point with a buddy over coffee, because we can still hide. So at the end of the day, there's no mechanism to guard your heart from itself. We have to keep our heart free and open and honest, transparent. That's why accountability groups don't work, because nobody actually knows what you've done wrong. So it's all voluntary if you don't. Yeah. Not, sorry, not that they don't work, but I mean, they don't. They're not a surefire guarantee. Yes. Because we can hide.
Yeah.
And human beings are really good at hiding. Pastors are really good at hiding.
And it is an energy spend, specifically for some personality types, to show up and give yourself, like, open up. I do really want to just thank you and your team at Practicing the Way for making beautiful resources and giving them away to the church for free.
Oh, it's my honor. We exist to serve the church and to serve pastors in particular. I love pastors. I love the church. And we want to help. I've been a pastor a long time. I know how hard it is, and we want to help.
And you guys have a new course coming out in April.
Mm-hmm.
And
the Practicing the Way course.
I think this is a real essential piece of the puzzle to make sense of even the whole body of Practicing the Way, the work.
Yes.
And just tell us really quickly about that.
Yeah, this is our newest work. It will be, I think, our kind of flagship resource. It's an 8-week. Basically a primer on spiritual formation. So I did just release a book called Practicing the Way that people can read alongside it, but this is not like a book study. This is its own standalone course that is designed to basically kind of walk somebody into a lifestyle of apprenticeship to Jesus. So it covers, you know, kind of just the mental model of what does it mean to be an apprentice of Jesus, and a life organized around the goals of being with Jesus, becoming like him, and doing as he did. It covers, you know, working theory of change, like how do we actually change? It covers psychospirituality, the practices. It covers emotional health and meeting God in our pain and suffering, and all the stuff that comes up in the practices, the where we attend to our shadow. It covers rule of life. It covers community. And people are kind of introduced to and integrate, if they choose to, about 5 kind of practices or disciplines into their kind of regular life with God, such as morning prayer and scripture reading and keeping of Sabbath and doing life with a small group of people around a table or in the confession of sin. So we're just trying to help people, if they can build kind of a lifestyle architecture of discipleship to Jesus, that then will enable them or enable God to build a whole spiritual house on top of that foundation over a lifetime. That'd be the dream. And churches can use it however they want. It's designed to be really flexible so that it's not invasive into the life of a church, but a service to the life of a church. But it would work really well. You could just do it as a standalone course, but it would also work really well as some kind of like a on-ramp into communities or coming out of Alpha or for people that are new to the church, or that's how a lot of churches are planning on utilizing it. And that would be wonderful. And then we kind of create other practices that could go on the backside of it.
Well, we're excited to use it as a church this fall. We're going to have all of our small groups go through it as a way to kind of introduce this vocabulary and this language to the life of our church. And then we see it as something that after it's kind of been, we got a bunch of us through it, something that we can offer annually as like, you know, because people are coming to know the Lord through Alpha and different things. And we want to be able to kind of give them a foundation. So I'm just so grateful for the work you and the team have done, your commitment to the local church, to give resources away. It's a great gift to us personally here in Vancouver. I know for a lot of pastors listening across Canada. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Jay. I think the world of you. Love the community that you're leading. And the pastors that every time I'm around your CCLN crew, they are just lovely people. Love this country. I love the church in this country. And it is an honor to talk to you.
So grateful to you, John Mark, for joining us. And I'm thankful for the work that you and the team at Praxing the Way are doing to resource the church in Canada and around the world. Before we go, I want to express gratitude to a few people who helped make this episode happen. Special thanks to Alex Brown and Ralph Alvaro for arranging, capturing, and editing today's conversation, and to Rachel Souza for helping us highlight our partners at the Canadian Bible Society. The Canadian Church Leaders Podcast is one of a number of things that we do as a ministry to strengthen and come alongside pastors in Canada. These episodes, along with our gatherings and leadership programs, are all made possible by a generous community called The Seed. The Seed is full of individuals and churches who want to link arms and give together so that pastors and churches across Canada can be strengthened for ministry that God has called them to. You can sign up to give at ccln.ca/give. And if you have any questions or want to chat more, reach out to us at contact@ccln.ca. In the episode description, you'll see a link to this and all the other things we mentioned in today's episode. Well, that's it from us today. Thank you for listening in, and we hope you'll join us again soon. Tons of love, and bye for now.